This week, gold, silver, and their shares flew higher, with the yellow metal finishing near 1,300, the best showing of the year, while Bitcoin soared to a new all-time record of 3,500. Welcome back, everyone. It's just a pleasure to rejoin you. Your host, Chris Walczak here. Well, what a remarkable week for the precious metals and the crypto market. Even the Dow Jones hit a new all-time record high before recoiling. Two big guests helped me make sense of the financial markets. Bill Murphy of Gata.org, an old friend of the show, returns with key insights on the precious metals. He's looking for $3,000-plus gold to adjust for real inflation levels. Then the head of the Trends Research Institute, Gerald Celente, returns to the show with big comments on the gold safe haven as well as the cryptocurrency markets. Amazingly, digital money is now $122 billion market cap. That's almost $30 billion more than when we first started monitoring it a few weeks ago. Gerald Celente thinks that policymakers are losing control over the currencies as citizens opt for versatile digital money. And we've had many requests for an update on MNY Capital and the ICO. The ICO evidently was canceled, a big disappointment for many of us. We have decided here at GoldSeek to just separate ourselves from the company and everything to do with it. This did happen on my watch, so I really have to bow to the waste here and sincerely apologize to everyone. It's been very disappointing for many of us, and I want to sincerely apologize. And one way that I can hopefully help out, anyone who'd like to take a screenshot of your entry and exits of the COE token, I'd like to offer you a 1 to 5 year newsletter subscription to help offset some of the losses. Folks, really sorry about this one. It's been a disappointment, and I think everyone knows we were putting in some pretty heavy-duty time and effort trying to help this story along, but it looks like something that was a great idea that just didn't pan out. Will they turn it around? Maybe, but we've got to stay clear from this and stick with our competitive edge, and that seems to be the precious metals. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. Remember, you can call into our toll-free hotline. We hope to get to that in the coming weeks. 1-641-715-3900. The extension number is 514049. 1-641-715-3900. Extension number 514049. Please jot it down on a post-it note or plug it right into your phone. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Well, visibility virtually unlimited over the precious metals sector on continued U.S. dollar weakness. Gold picked up $30, ending just shy of $1,300, the highest close of the year, while silver blasted higher 5%, 82 cents, ending over 17 an ounce. The precious metals XAU shares also tacked on 2 points, 2.5%, ending at 84. Black gold treaded water after an explosive week, just shy of 49 a barrel and above that key support, hopefully still poised for a run to 60 per barrel. Meanwhile, the top story driving the precious metals sector, increased tensions between the West and North Korea boosted demand for safe haven assets. Geopolitical risks are pushing up premiums for conservative investments, and many analysts are calling for the trend to continue. Reports indicated that officials in North Korea released hypothetical plans on how to strike the U.S. and our military bases in Guam and just how that might play out. The new administration followed with harsh comments. Gold is still up over 10% for the year, according to CBS MarketWatch. Legendary investor Ray Dalio, chairman and chief investment officer at Bridgewater, he urged investors to hedge their risks with gold amid increasing geopolitical tensions, noting that gold tends to climb in anticipation of conflict, but often it's a buy the rumor, sell the fact. They're calling for at least $1,350 an ounce. Elsewhere on Friday, news from the U.S. government indicated that U.S. consumer prices remain low for a fifth month. This was released on the heels of a report Thursday indicating soft producer-level inflation. The news pushed the greenback lower on Friday, which boded well for low interest-bearing assets like the precious metals. Precious metals, bottom line. This week, the geopolitical tensions and the U.S. equities weakness obviously led to stronger precious metals prices. The cup and handle or head and shoulders pattern in gold could catapult the entire sector to $1,450 an ounce, hopefully in the coming weeks and months ahead. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly sunny skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange. The Dow Jones recoiled from a new all-time high, giving back 234 points. Ending the week at 21,858. The S&P dropped 36, about 1.5%, finishing at 2441, while the NASDAQ gave back 95 at 6256. Lastly, the Bitcoin ETF added 30%, 142 points, closing at yet another all-time record high, like Bitcoin itself, at 616. Folks, we first started tracking this, the Bitcoin ETF, at right around 100. It's at six-fold higher. It's done quite well following the Bitcoin Cash fork. And, of course, our Komodo coin added 10% this week, finishing at about a buck and a dime. Another digital currency, Ethereum, was mostly unchanged around $300 on Friday, according to a CoinDesk report. While the Bitcoin offshoot, Bitcoin Cash, was up 13%, ending higher than Ethereum at $330. Bitcoin has essentially tripled in value for the year. One report noted that institutions are waking up to its merits due in part to the uncorrelated nature of digital money to typical asset classes. Bottom line on U.S. equities and cryptos. The Dow really hit an all-time record, as I mentioned, but rolled over. And our 7-indicator greed to fear index is finally showing some really fearful levels. So hopefully investors will search for a bottom in the coming weeks. According to one media source, Ray Dalio noted that this is the second longest bull market in history, and it's likely that this could be a pause that refreshes. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio with our two big guests. It's just a pleasure to welcome Top Trends researcher and publisher of the Trends Journal. With the top trends impacting the economy and the geopolitical arena and even the Bitcoin blockchain phenomenon, which a lot of folks are getting excited about. Welcome back, Gerald Celente.
Well, thank you, Chris.
I thought we could start off with what's going on in the topicality that's sort of keeping you up or, you know, raising red flags.
You know, the markets keep going up and not a lot pushing them up other than hoping political economic change you could believe in, but we think the markets are going to have a correction at some point. We don't see a crash coming, but what we're mostly concerned about, of course, are geopolitical issues. Things are heating up with the sanctions now against Iran and Russia and North Korea, and things are heating up in the Middle East as well. So we're concerned very much about that, and that's why, of course, you know, people are looking for safe havens. And gold, of course, being one of them. And cryptocurrency is another one. You see, this whole phenomenon keeps going on. We don't see any end in sight. People are looking for alternatives to fiat currencies.
That's just the topic I wanted to talk about today. Cryptocurrencies, blockchain, Bitcoin, Ethereum. It's a controversial topic. Have you ever seen a more polarized topic, maybe since gold and silver?
You look at the cryptocurrencies. I mean, Japan now, for example, is allowed, you know, transactions to be done in Bitcoin. And that was one of the reasons why you saw its price rise so much. And there's such a, you know, again, with interest rates, we don't know if they're going to go up or down. If currencies start getting devalued, people in these countries are very quick to bail out of their currencies and go into a cryptocurrency. That's, again, one of the reasons why Bitcoin really started taking off earlier was when the yuan started going down and the Chinese people looking for alternatives. As far as blockchain technology, I mean, it's real, and it's happening in banking systems throughout the world. So it's not going to wait or going away. It's only going to increase in a lot of different areas. So again, there's ups and downs to it, too, because one of the big downs is you don't know if a country, as I mentioned, now it's okay in Japan to do business in Bitcoin. And I mentioned China before. You know, Bitcoin went down when China started putting new regulations and questions and demands on Bitcoin trading. So you never know if a government is going to reverse course on something like this.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up because it has its risks. You know, we have to put that on the table. But at the same time, what I see is the powers that be fighting it. That always gets me interested. How much risk is there when you look at the typical shares out there, inflated beyond belief and manipulated like crazy, 70, 80% maybe more high-frequency trading? And at least you know, the blockchain, that you are hidden somewhere in there. I mean, you're locked in there mathematically. And that mathematical formula, that algorithm, ensures I'm a shareholder in this currency. You know, we have some really sharp folks there, one of whom is a big hedge fund manager. He was the one to correctly call this big rally we've had in Bitcoin. You know, he said 5,000 by 2018, so that's next year, and then onwards to 50 and then 100,000. Two more top analysts, neither of whom are big fans of cryptocurrencies, are calling now for 50,000. Is that pie in the sky?
You know, you can't tell. I don't know. But what we do know, and we are forecasting, there are going to be a lot more cryptocurrencies coming on. You're seeing it already happening. And there's going to be more and more ways also that people are interested in, again, in the whole question of bailing out of fiat currencies. I mentioned China. I mean, look at the debt-to-GDP ratio in China, when it's over 300%. And is Chinese economy going to crash? No, we don't think so at all, because they're going to do everything they can to keep pumping it up. So that's what we're looking at. Those, again, are the reasons why we don't see it ending. We see new ones coming online and see it expanding. We've been saying this for quite a while now, and we haven't changed our forecast. They're not going to go away, but again, you know, there's always the wild cards out there. And the wild cards are that if a country is watching its currency decline rapidly, what are they going to do to prevent it from happening? Are they going to stop a Bitcoin deal, a new Bitcoin, an old Bitcoin, from happening? Let's take a look at Venezuela, for example. You know, look at the crisis going on over there. So people can't afford gold. They can't afford silver. They may not afford, you know, Bitcoin, but all of a sudden, you know, something comes out that they can't afford, and they want to have some kind of
insurance
for holding on to bolivars that are turning more and more worthless. So that's where you see these kind of things happen, and particularly as we become more and more of a digital world. Like, for example, like in China, you know, people aren't using, you go to Shanghai, you know, all the reports coming out, people aren't using cash anymore. You know, they just put their smartphone up and bam, that's it. So it becomes an exchange value that can happen between people. It doesn't have to involve the government. So that could also be the kind of thing that happens. Because with more and more people used to paying without cash, you know, what is the new cash? Where does it come from? How they're going to, you know, who's going to create it? So there can be new things coming on for different ways, different purchases, different ways of looking at it, and it's growing. It's not stopping.
I'd just like to throw a couple numbers out there that, believe it or not, I think it was $982 billion the last time I checked it. I had to triple check it. I just didn't believe it. It's up on the, you can find it on our page. Again, we're talking about something that just sprung out of nowhere. Estimates now are calling for $5 trillion in the next few years. You know, Gerald Celente, that's the entire market cap, I kid you negative, of the Forex market, largest market in the world. You know, it seems like the powers that be still haven't quite woken up. Dr. Janet Yellen, chairwoman, our Fed head, just said we have zero jurisdiction over cryptocurrencies. Now, how long that'll last, I don't know. So do you expect this to be something that becomes side by side with the typical currency? It's obviously not going to replace the dollar, but could it become a new standard?
Not going away. That's what we're saying. It's only going to continue to grow. New ones are going to develop and in new areas. And again, we're looking at a total change in society. Again, the cashless society is very big. It's one of our top trends for 2017. When you're going cashless, all you want is the value of whatever you're buying to be worth what it used to be or better. And there is where cashless comes in, because you could go anywhere. And then you look at all of these, you know, new companies that are developing, new, you know, online people are raising money, and they're doing it with their form of cryptocurrencies. So they're not going to go away. And it's very important, because the younger generations, you know, particularly the millennial generation and the new ones coming in, you know, it's a digital world to them. And again, look at China. Particularly, you know, the larger cities. It's going cashless. So whether it's a yuan or a bitcoin or whatever cryptocurrency comes in, we believe there's just going to be an increase in this development. Again, I have to be very open-minded on this. If you all of a sudden, and you saw it happen with China, all of a sudden when people are bailing out of the yuan and going into the Bitcoin, all of a sudden, you know, they slapped down on it. But then again, after they did, they relaxed it, and then it continued to grow again. So it's always that reality that you don't know if a government is going to intervene. But having said that, it's a global economy now, and in the truest sense. And when you look at blockchain, and you look at all the banks and the banking systems that are going into it, it's not going away. It's only going to grow. Again, that's, you know, my forecast for Bitcoins.
But I'm just curious on Bitcoin. Do you see a higher number in the future?
It could blow up to too much, and then people are going to abandon it and go into something else. You're already seeing the something else. There's plenty of opportunity out there. And again, I'm only giving a forecast for the cryptocurrencies. And my forecast is what I've said to you, is what I've been saying on Trends in the News and other interviews as well in the set and writing, that we see the future of a cashless society. And in the future of a cashless society, you're going to see new forms of cash. Simple as that.
All right, Gerald Celente, you know, it's late at night, and we just thank you for making time for us today.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Just a pleasure to welcome back Bill Murphy, head of Gold Antitrust Committee, GATA, with Chris Powell. They're exposing the gold market manipulation from his home in Dallas. Welcome back, Bill Murphy.
Anytime, Chris.
Interesting article this week, the European Union halting withdrawals from the financial system. But when the ECB ministers, you know, are printing like mad, and then you start to see curtailing of withdrawals, that makes people nervous. Now, they claim, I think it actually stated here, that they're nervous about bank runs. Should they be nervous about bank runs?
Well, as you know, bank runs come out of nowhere when people aren't ready for them. What do I know about what's going on in Europe and these different, you know, over the past years and different countries over there that have had some serious problems, and they've all been rectified. But then all of a sudden, you hit the wall, and all these things pile up, and one thing, you know, leads to another, and you have a bank run, and it happens, you know, out of nowhere. So, you know, it's something to pay attention to.
You know, Fed policymakers made the markets a little bit nervous. They gave a bid to the greenback last week, and I guess somewhat this week. But really, if we look at the Fed funds futures contracts, really low odds of rate hikes next year. Maybe by the middle or early spring of 2018, could we see another rate hike? And the precious metals, they seem to be ignoring the Fed here. Can you give us more input on that?
Well, you know, the yield of the 10-year note at 2.21% really hasn't done anything, and there are a lot of us in our camp that being portrayed by the statistics that are out there, and that's the reason that, you know, they're talking how great everything is, and yet in reality the average person in America is not doing that well, and I think they're scared to death of raising rates, of what it might do. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
You know, there was an interesting article this week, I don't have the author or the paper in front of me, that indicated that gold could soar to unimaginable levels, like we haven't seen ever before, 50, 60, 65,000, I think was the author's target. And I think you're right to keep us on track, keep us level-headed and say, hey, let's take this one step at a time, 1,500, 2,000, and beyond. Do you give any credence to these forecasts?
Well, you know, those numbers seem way out there, but you know what the heck? If things get out of control, who knows what could happen? I mean, where my where I come from is that, you know, they ratcheted up the stock market, central banks, and our government buying it, and, it, you know, it never corrects, and you have all these fundamental reasons for gold to be much higher and stays in the tank. Silver, until the last few days, is the worst acting market I think I've ever seen in my life. That can all be in the process of ending, and once the bad guys, as I call them, the gold cartel, loses control, anything could happen on the upside. And if our government is forced to hyperinflate to save off mega problems on the downside, there's no telling what gold and silver market. I'm hoping we're finally underway. It's taking forever, but when you talk about a gold price, I mean, I think something extremely reasonable is 3 to 5,000. If gold had kept pace with inflation, forget all the other factors, it would be $3,400 an ounce right now.
Do you think that the U.S. equities market is drawing some of the attention away from the precious metals and their shares? I mean, obviously, investors just can't get enough of U.S. equities. I think the Dow had something like 9 higher highs in a row. And we're seeing a lot of sector rotation, you know, where one week it's the blue chips that are hot, the next week it's the NASDAQ and tech companies that are back in vogue. Give us an idea of just how important this might be, or at least what a factor it will be with the coming bull market in precious metals, which probably looks imminent by now.
Well, you know, it's interesting because of what the stock market has done and because of the pressure the gold cartel has put on the gold and silver prices. The sentiment, the bullish sentiment, is probably the worst it's been in 30 years. It's quite a statement to make, but I mean, I really mean it. This is how bad it is, and for people in the industry and so on. And because the stock market just goes up and up and up, and if you're involved in various art deals and so on, it keeps going up in real estate, and Bitcoin going bonkers. And so people are just losing interest in the gold and silver market because people like us that are bullish and it hasn't happened, they said the heck with it. And it's, you know, it's human nature being what it is. It's taking its toll. Now that can change very quickly, and it's the stock market really corrects and starts to fall apart. And so we get a little more momentum in gold and silver. I mean, it could be astounding what gold and silver could do in a very short period of time.
Can you give us an idea of what you think could be the impetus to lift this market higher? You know, we've been in this trading range, it feels like, the better part of 2017. The markets look like they just need a kick. You know, they need a push, something to knock us out of this range. Do you see anything on the horizon that might help us?
You've nailed it. And I think, that, as I call it, there's gold and silver accidents waiting to happen on the upside. And I think this North Korea thing could be giving it the impetus, because often geopolitical events that, you know, we hear about, the market goes up, gold and silver go right back down again. It has happened time and time and time again. This may be different in the fact that gold and silver were getting ready to take off anyway. And this could end up being the black swan or gray rhino that we haven't seen in the gold and silver market, I mean, in markets in general or financial news in a very long time. So, you know, I just think it's time is here, and people might be quite surprised about what gold can silver do in a short period of time.
Yeah, that's a great point. I just read recently that folks in Alaska, folks I think in Guam, Hawaii, and of course Japan, are really unsettled by the potential threat of these intercontinental missiles, or at least the sabers being rattled there. And it's unnerved a lot of people, even along the West Coast, all the way up to Vancouver. You know, this is just a potential issue. May not be keeping many people up at night, but it's just that extra question mark, you know, that you have to keep in mind now. All right. Well, as we wrap up here today, do you care to put any forecasts on the precious metals?
I would like to say that, you know, I think what's going to take gold and silver higher is when this gold cartel has trouble keeping the price down and the physical markets overpower them a bit. And you brought up some good stuff about, you know, the gold market and the physical situation. And I'm hoping that the silver market has reached a tipping point for J.P. Morgan and their forces. I mean, some of the major producers, it was just reported their production is down 20 to 40%. At least it was in the second quarter. That's a big drop. And if they were already on fumes, then it just could be that the physical markets in gold and silver are setting up to, you know, lead the way higher and make these price suppression efforts impossible at these prices. And that's what I'm counting on now. And so I think we could have a good fall.
All right, Bill Murphy, we appreciate your thoughts. Why don't you tell people more about the La Metropole Cafe, please?
I've been writing a column on there since September of 1998. People can sign up for a 2-week free trial, see if it's of interest. And my colleague Chris Powell does a great job with GATA, of course, and go to GATA.org and get on his list. And we're still out there fighting the good fight.
At some point, I think investors, many of whom maybe don't even remember dot-com bust. I think a lot of these money managers, they haven't even seen the year 2007, 2008 collapse. And I think then the precious metals will come back and vote. Thanks for making time for us today.
Anytime, Chris.
Dr. Lawrence Kotlikoff, hailing from Moscow, Russia today, professor of economics at Boston University, author of Clash of the Generations and the Inform Act. Welcome back, Professor Kotlikoff.
Thanks for having me.
I understand you have some colleagues there and working on a project.
Putting together a global climate change model, myself and a group of Russian economists, we've actually used this model to look at the impact of tax reform in the U.S., like the reform that the House Ways and Means Committee is considering right now, which would make some dramatic changes to the corporate income tax. And actually, the House tax proposal quotes three different articles I've written in its presentation of its proposal. So, as well as a co-authored book. That's our Get What's Yours, The Secrets to Maxing Out Your Social Security. That's a different book. The thing I was referring to was not actually now I think about it, it's not a book. It's a co-authored article with Alan Auerbach, who's a professor at Berkeley. Anyway, the bottom line is that there are some parts of this House tax plan which are really going to help the economy a lot. But there's some other features of the tax plan that raise some concerns about how much revenue it might lose. So there's good incentives for companies to invest in the U.S. under the tax plan, but there's some aspects of it that look like giveaways to companies that don't really need to be given freebies. So I think with some tweaks, it could be a great tax reform. So that's a good thing. There's not a lot of people saying good things about the Trump administration at this point for, I think, good reason, because we haven't seen a lot of, I think, really sensible appointments to the cabinet positions. At least everybody seems to have some sort of baggage associated with them, or lack of knowledge about what department they're supposed to be running. In this area, I don't think they're doing a good job, and I don't know that it's coming from the Trump himself. I think it's really coming from the House Ways and Means Committee.
You have noted that Social Security is significantly underfinanced by, I think you mentioned, 33% or more. Keeps in line with the idea of some fiscal difficulties ahead. You've also talked about the budget office and spending on defense and Justice Department salaries, things of that nature. Do you think that we're still on the road to 200 plus trillion national debt when everything's included?
Yeah, the country's definitely broke. The Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, as well as the president-elect, don't seem to understand it. We do have this fiscal gap of what is now $206 trillion, which is the difference in present value, which is just the value in the present, of all the projected future spending, including servicing the official debt. All the expenditures on everything that the government's going to be spending, paying for, including gassing up Air Force One, paying for Supreme Court justices' salaries, paying for the military, all the spending, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, all that spending out into the future, present value it, and compare that with the present value of taxes, and we're short $206 trillion. Now, that's 10 years of GDP. That's bankruptcy. The country really is at this point bankrupt, but the politicians don't understand it. The public doesn't get it. Some politicians do understand it, but are too afraid or unwilling to tell the truth about the situation. So this is hardly the time to be losing any revenue in any tax reform. It is a time to fix the incentives to invest in this country, but also we should do it in a way that raises and doesn't lower revenue, and then we should also go look at the spending side and fix that as well. And I've, if you go to kotlikoff.net, kotlikoff.net, you'll see a book, in this case an actual book that I wrote, which is called You're Hired! A Trump Playbook for Fixing America. Now, this book is about 100 pages. It's free. and just download it, read it, send it to all your members of Congress and to the president-elect. And it has a sensible fix for health care, a sensible fix for Social Security, a sensible fix for banking, a sensible fix for the tax system. It's different from the tax reform that the House Ways and Means Committee is proposing, but it's similar in many ways to what in the at the bottom line, it's similar, but it doesn't lose revenue like their proposal seems to be likely to do. And there's proposals for how to fix part of the welfare system. We need to make sure that people have incentives to work. And when you look at our fiscal system, there's something like 20 different fiscal programs, each of which has their own tax system. For example, if you earn more money in your own food stamps, you can lose 23 cents on the dollar. You can lose 15 cents on the dollar from Obamacare if we keep that in place the way it is. You can lose 22 cents on the dollar on your income tax credit. So you can, you know, so if you're a poor person working at McDonald's and you have a family of four, you could easily be in a 60% tax bracket or even a 1,000% tax bracket if you earn enough money to lose your Medicaid benefits. You know, in some a lot of states, you're in a situation where if you earn a dollar too much, you can lose Medicaid for your, not just for yourself, but for all your family members, and that can constitute thousands of dollars of lost benefits. So what we're doing is we're trapping poor people and higher income people and not working, and poor people into poverty, and we're inducing older people not to work because of all the disincentives they face, including the earnings test from Social Security. So we need to fix not just the tax system, but Social Security and the healthcare system so that, and the welfare system, these four things together in a consistent way so that we give people the right incentives to work. And that's what I propose in this book. So I highly recommend everybody read this. It'll be an education about the true fiscal picture, but also, so it's not just that we're broke, but we have these terrible incentives to not work. You know, we've got this balkanized system that is giving people the wrong incentives when it comes to thinking about working. Who's going to work if you have to hand Uncle Sam 70 cents on the dollar? Just doesn't happen. You have to really understand all these different programs and put them together in one analysis to really see the true problem in this area. So I'm hoping that somebody down there in Washington will take a look at this book, fix things accordingly. I'm not optimistic. You know, I think that this set of politicians will be like former sets of politicians and keep driving the country into more and more red ink. The $206 trillion is a credit card bill. It grows with interest. So if we just sit back and do nothing, it's going to be $6 trillion bigger next year. That's the true deficit we're running. And the numbers that are being provided to us by the Congressional Budget Office are just really misleading and intentionally so, because the members of Congress want to hide the truth about this problem. They don't want to reveal the fact that we're this much in debt because they want to keep getting reelected. So they like to cut taxes or increase spending. They just fight as to which of their constituents should get a freebie. But the truth of the matter is we're just leaving our kids with this enormous bill that's going to bankrupt them. Thomas Jefferson is surely rolling over in his grave because he was who railed against this passing the generational buck behavior. If you Google Jefferson and generations, you'll see quotes about his positions on this.
Exactly. He was quite the architect, I believe, writing into the literature that we must have sound money. I think they had just obviously witnessed so much of the economic turmoil in France, which was at the time an ally, a century of economic turmoil from unsound money. And I'd like to move on, though, to one of your recent comments here on the show. You pointed out your concern about the U.S. Treasury and obviously debt being a primary issue there, noting this months in advance of the Treasury collapse we've seen. Economists don't typically have the best track record as far as market timing and calls are concerned. We go back to Fisher, who called a permanent plateau in stocks just before the 1929 crash.
Yeah, I think interest rates still have miles to go up, and therefore bond prices have miles to go down, because the reality is when you're this broke, you print money, and we've been printing money. I must have said this on the show last time. the Fed has printed money out the wazoo since 2007, primarily under Geithner, Bernanke. Janet Yellen has stopped the printing of money, but there's all this money basically that's been printed that the Fed has then bribed the banks to hold in reserves, but the banks are free to lend out this money at any time, and as interest rates go up, they're going to start doing that. That means that all this money, about $2.3 or so trillion dollars, is going to get into the bloodstream of the economy, and that's going to raise this, what we call the money multiplier, back to where it was in 2007. And then as prices start to rise, the rate at which people transact, which is called the velocity of money, will go back to where it was in 2007. And if you have these two things happen, which is the money multiplier and the velocity of money return to their 2007 levels, we'll get an increase in prices of 300%. So we have the basis for hyperinflation created by Ben Bernanke under the heading quantitative easing. You know, Ben's a friend of mine. He's an economist. I've known him for a long time. Not a close friend of his, but he tried his best. And, you know, his policy that he pursued was not what I would have done. I think it was quite dangerous. He felt it was important to get the country back on its feet. But you could argue that what he did was reckless when it comes to potential for inflation, and also might have scared the country more than it was scared. He and Hank Paulson together, he was a former Treasury Secretary. Bill, you know, when you look at the way they dealt with the crisis in 2008, when Lehman Brothers went down, they didn't try and calm the public. They said, this is a terrible crisis. We could have another Great Depression. Wall Street's gone crazy. We need $700 billion to bail out Wall Street. You could just as well have said, you know, if you look at the Lehman Brothers, Lehman Building, it's not collapsed. All the people who used to work at Lehman haven't died, a single one of them. So physically nothing's happened. The building will get used by somebody else, and those people get hired by somebody else. So the real economy has not really been affected. If everybody gets psyched out and panics, yes, things will go downhill. But I wouldn't bet on that. So they left us in a situation where we can have hyperinflation and interest rates can go up dramatically and bond prices can fall dramatically. And I know this is a show about gold to some extent, and certainly gold should do better in that environment.
Do you worry at all, though, that interest rates might have a negative impact? It didn't seem to matter during the 70s, but the economic scenario here, the dynamics have shifted. We don't have the industrial base intact that we did then.
Well, I think the economy has been able to grow with high interest rates. It's been able to grow with low interest rates. It's been able to grow with inflation. It's been able to grow even with deflation. And if you look at the, I think, 1880s or so, we had about 15 years of high growth in the country and prices were falling. So there's kind of two questions here. What's going to happen to specific prices of specific securities like bonds, like long-term bonds? If you're getting 3 or 4% on a long-term treasury right now, 30-year treasury, and interest rates go up to 6%, you're going to lose a lot of money in those treasuries. Same with any long-term corporate bond or long-term municipal bond. So even if the economy, whether the economy is doing well or poorly, you're going to get hurt in that environment from those interest rates going up. But then the other thing, you know, about, well, you know, will these kinds of things, would high inflation or high interest rates produce a recession? I think a lot of this is psychological. So if people start pulling out their hair over high interest rates and high inflation, and they say this is the end of the world, then the economy can go into a recession, because if one employer gets it into their mind that the other employers are scared about the future, then that employer, that first employer, is going to think that the other employer is going to start firing their workers, and those workers are the first employer's customers. And then the first employer is going to fire his workers, who are the second employer's customers. So you can get the entire economy to melt down as we saw it melt down in 2008 just by having people panic, employers panic. So if you look at what happened right after Lehman Brothers went down and we had the government, all these government officials, including President Bush, go nuts and, you know, suggest that this was going to be the next Great Depression. The employers didn't wait around to see what was going to happen. They just started laying off people immediately. You had about 500,000 people being laid off per month for the first couple of months after Lehman's went down. And then it was up to around 700,000 by December. Lehman went down in September 2008. And by December 2008, we had like 700,000 being laid off per month. That's close to the population of Boston. You know, not the metropolitan area, but just I think Boston and Burke. So I got that right. So psychology matters a lot to what happens. You're going to have the Fed talk people out of inflation or talk them into inflation for a while. But in the end, at some point, the realities of what's going on take over. So if the Fed has printed all this money, and it, you know, at some point, if it does get it, it will get into the bloodstream of the economy and matter. Well, I think it's already happened. You know, the fact that we can't structure, the fact that we can't, that we've been not keeping up with our nuclear weapons or shrinking our military in certain areas, or reducing our investment in research and development at the federal government level, or cutting back on healthcare in different ways, that is a signal that the country's broke. You know, that's the reality. The country is broken. You're seeing it through these different, you're seeing it in the potholes in the roads. You're seeing it in the bridges that are described by the engineers as dangerously out of repair, or as signs of a country that's in fiscal stress, doesn't seem to understand it yet collectively.
But really at the heart of it, you say, again, we're broke. I mean, you point out GDP just isn't enough to keep up with the borrowing. And you make this clear, we're not broke 10 years, 20, 50 years from now. It's today. What are the implications?
If everybody really understood the fiscal situation, that we're in much worse shape than, for example, as a federal government than, for example, Detroit, basically maybe like 2.5 times worse shape. They were underfunded by about 20%. Our federal government's underfunded by about 53%, meaning we need to increase taxes by about 53%, every single federal tax, to pay for all the spending that we have planned to do. And I'm talking about every single tax going up immediately and permanently by 53%. You know, once people collectively get that picture, then they're going to realize that the government is likely to print money to try and pay these bills, because that's what politicians do in countries that are broke. They print money. You know, you saw this in 20 different cases in the last century. You had hyperinflations in Hungary and Germany and different countries, Argentina, Russia, Israel had hyperinflation. Countries that get into fiscal trouble, the first thing they do is print money. And then you look at what the Federal Reserve has been doing, and it increased the money supply by about $3.2 trillion. I mean, it printed about $3.2 trillion over a 7-year period. And that's unheard of. You know, the basic money supply, the amount of money that the federal government had printed between the Federal Reserve had printed between 1913, when it was founded, and 2007 was 2007 was about $800 billion, and today it's about $3.2 trillion. So it wasn't an increase of $3.2 trillion. It's up to $3.2 trillion now. So it was about $2.4 trillion that was printed. So the basic money supply has quadrupled in the last 7-8 years, thanks to the Federal Reserve policy. So I'm not talking about excessive policy. I'm talking about a wild policy that the Federal Reserve has run, you know, something we've never, ever seen in the history of the country for 100 years. And then we see over this fairly short period of time, this decision to go wild with the printing of money, all under the somehow benign title of quantitative easing. What it's doing was easing the burden on Congress, the responsibility of Congress and the president to pay for what it spends. That's really what happened here. All this printing of money didn't actually turn the economy around dramatically. You know, the recovery from the recession was extremely slow. I don't think we have yet fully recovered from the recession. We still have an employment to population ratio that's about 2 percentage points below where it should be in a normal recovery. So it's not like all this money printing actually eased the recession in any significant way. It just put us at risk. It kept the taxes down and the spending high, and left us at risk for high inflation.
You know, there's been considerable news under the radar screen that our policymakers are writing into legislature this idea of guaranteed income, and it seems to go hand in hand with the idea that the nation is broke, and perhaps even worldwide. The system appears to be broke in the periphery. Venezuela, horrible currency hyperinflation starting there, and then we have issues in India where the economy has been virtually shut down due to currency related, trying to go to a digital system. Do you think that this basic guaranteed income of some sort might become, you know, something we hear from our legislators?
Well, we have to worry about the automation of the of jobs. You know, the fact that smart machines are taking over jobs everywhere you look. So we've got kind of a winner take all economic system right now, where you've got these CEOs and getting absolutely astronomical salaries, and a lot of other people are not seeing pay increases for decades. When you have Amazon and Google telling us that they're going to automate transportation and the delivery of goods and not have any people involved in delivering this stuff, you know, we're going to have trucks that drive themselves and taxis that drive themselves. We're going to have drones that drop their packages in our front yard. We've got 7% of the workforce in transportation in our country right now. These people are going to be out of work. If you look at the local drugstore, there's nobody there at the counter. You've got a machine you're checking out with. There's no toll booth workers anymore in the Massachusetts Turnpike, because they've just gotten rid of all those toll booths, because it's all being done by a camera that takes a picture of your license plate and sends you a bill. So we have to worry about the income distribution. Now, a guaranteed income that's high enough to really take care of a family of four would require astronomical tax rates. So we need to make sure that we have a progressive system, but still maintain incentives to work. So that's what I thought about very carefully when I wrote this book, which again is called You're Hired, A Trump Playbook for Fixing America's Economy, which is at kotlikoff.net. You know, how do you actually get a reasonable income distribution so that people that have been put out of work by these machines have something to live on? Because guess what? If they can't get some income, they will not be able to buy the goods and services that these machines are making. They won't be able to afford a car to drive through the tolls, the toll boothless highways, and pay the tolls, because they won't be able to drive anywhere. They won't be able to order stuff from Amazon because they won't be able to afford it. So this whole thing may not work as a macroeconomic outcome. The people at Amazon and Google need to think about who's going to buy their goods and services if they put everybody out of work. So we have to have, in this situation, aggressive redistribution of money from the winners to the losers, so that the economy doesn't end up worse off. I've written papers about this, about robots. I wrote a paper that's on that same website, kotlikoff.net, called Robots Are Us, which shows that this process of automating jobs and having very smart machines who can do virtually anything a human can do can lead to the immiseration of the economy, that everybody in the long run can be worse off through time because of just what I said. People get thrown out of work or thrown out of good work, and then they can't afford to buy the products. And then in the long run, you have better technology, but you have less physical capital, and you end up actually with everybody being poorer. So we have to be concerned, but we have to fix things in a very precise way. So this is not a job for our amateurs. And the Trump administration so far has not a single economist associated with it. There's not a single academic economist who's been given any position, who's involved in the transition discussion. He apparently doesn't believe economists have anything to add. That's really tragic. We need economists at this point to help fix the country.
It's a great topic. We've been discussing it now for a few months on the show. But what's interesting is, I don't know if you saw the article just in the past week that showed a company in Japan just replaced something like, I want to say, 20 call center employees, analyst level, which has sort of been a stronghold against automation, if you will, or AI, whatever term you want to use. But what apparently they incorporated IBM's computer that, of course, won the Jeopardy show. In 2 years' time, reached break even. And from that point, they're saving over $100,000 per year net by replacing 20 jobs. And sure, that might make the shareholders happy as their shares increase substantially. But again, as you say, if there's no one to buy the cars, how have we really benefited? But is it really just a cotton gin scenario? I mean, you might recall it replaced approximately 50 workers, each cotton gin. And eventually those folks were redistributed throughout the economy. Are we crossing a new threshold here where we can't put those workers into productive positions?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to know. The cotton gin and the railroad are good examples of things that, you know, we have up till now, well, I would say up till about the 60s at least, been able to absorb new technology that took away jobs, but new things opened up. But it seems like the rate of automation has increased and that the ability of these smart machines to do things that are very human-like has increased as well. So I think the nature of the technology is different now that's coming along. There's very few things you can think of that a machine can't do, including rub your back and massage your back. You know, I'm a professor of economics. We could have a handful of economists provide lectures that are videotaped and then provided to every university in the country or the world and put all the economists out of work. So it's not just actuaries that have to worry about this, but it's professors as well. Why do you need to have your own professor? Why not just watch a video of somebody else teaching? There's something different about the technology that's going on today. So I'm worried about it. Most people would have said, well, you're a Luddite. We've had technological change for a long time, and it's always been beneficial. But, you know, I don't see it these days. And I look at the real wages of U.S. workers, and the average weekly take-home pay of U.S. workers is basically no higher after inflation than it was in the 1960s. So the American dream has pretty well come to an end, that every generation would have it better. Yes, lots of rich people in the country have it a whole lot better, but the typical worker does not. We got to do something. It starts with sensible fiscal reforms and sensible banking reform, sensible health care reform, and sensible Social Security reform. And that's all in the book. So, again, I hope your listeners will take a look at the book at CutlerCuff.net, read it and pass it along, and maybe we can make a difference down there in Washington.
Thank you, Professor Kotlikoff, and we wish you the best of luck in your travels.
My pleasure. Thank you for calling.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Peter Leides, editor and publisher of Stock Market Cycles, in the markets for many decades. It's a pleasure to have him back on the show. Welcome back, Peter Leides.
Thanks a lot, Chris. I appreciate that. It kind of makes me feel old when you say many decades in the market, but it's true. I believe that we are, in terms of price and magnitude of moves, I believe we're very close to a market top. But having said that, I will also say that on the intermediate term, short to intermediate term, I think we are, in fact, we may be at a market top. But I don't believe it's going to be the final market top. There are so many things happening internally in the market, Chris, in terms of strength and breadth and advanced decline line and 52-week highs that intimate that if this is going to be a top, then it's not going to last very long, that there should be a higher high after this, or at least a test of these highs with the kind of divergences we like to begin to see at market tops. We have not seen those divergences yet, and that's one of the main reasons why it does not make sense that we're at a top here. On the other hand, if we look at things on a more fundamental basis, and I very seldom do that, but there certainly is a very strong argument, as you stated, that money has to go somewhere, and right now we look like the only game in town to a lot of people with a lot of money.
I wonder if you could tell your thoughts on the market sentiment. It seems a bit frothy. The put-to-call ratio and several other metrics just seem to indicate that maybe bullishness has reached almost a fevered pitch.
Yeah, I would agree with that also. I don't know as I go so far to say a fevered pitch, but it is certainly in many metrics as high or higher than it's been in quite a long period of time. In fact, we could argue that it's higher now and many measurement factors than it was at the highs in May of 2015 for most of the market averages. And let's also point out, Chris, that the New York Composite Index, which is theoretically at least the most broadly based of all market measurements with every stock on the New York Exchange, has not yet gone to a new high above the May 2015 highs. That high, by the way, was one that I did not think would be broken by either the Dow or the S&P. And now that it has been, I think we really are living on borrowed time here. I can see this extending into the fall. But, of course, the fall is only a couple of months away now. We get ourselves a decent decline here and then a move back to these levels with, as I said earlier, the kind of deterioration internally in the market that I think is required to see an important top. And we may be looking at something that's a lot more important.
few years ago, you could count on virtually a good solid 3, 4, 5, 7% return on a diversified portfolio. Those days are, they're just gone. It's ancient history. You're lucky to earn 1, 2% dividend yields, of course, across the board on the S&P. And, of course, the price-to-earnings ratio, very extended relative to historic norms. We have the bond market as well, reaching extremely frothy levels simultaneously. This just doesn't traditionally occur, tend to be more negatively correlated, that is, stocks and bonds. Can you give us some reasoning behind it, or would you prefer to stick with the technicals?
Well, I think you've hit upon the exact reasoning for it, Chris, and that is that they're, let's look at it this way. The people we have to feel sorry for, and I'm moving into that category myself, are the people that have worked hard all their lives, amassed themselves a certain amount of money that they figured they could retire on, a comfortable interest rate, conservatively gained at 5, 6, maybe even 7% if they were lucky, and they'd be set for the rest of their lives. Well, guess what they're getting now? You know as well as I do that they can't make 1% on their money. So if you're faced with that after these decades of hard work and labor, figuring you'd be okay if you amassed a certain amount of money, they now have to become seekers of market return, and they go out and do things they should not be doing. They should not be putting money in places where there is risk involved. But indeed, that's the only place where they have any promise at all of making money. So that becomes a huge problem, and it's a problem that in pretty big fashion and not too far away. But it's hard to put your finger on exactly when the price is going to start to be paid for all of that. I mean, what rising interest rates are going to do is finally make these people, the fixed income people that have worked for so long to get themselves some money they can retire with, a little happier. But on the other hand, that's going to completely rip apart our system that is so heavily based on debt right now, both on an individual consumer basis and on the governmental basis. So it's almost a no-win proposition, Chris, in terms of the next 2 or 3 years.
I don't think a host could ask for a better segue into alternatives to the paper assets, because chasing a yield is just a non sequitur at this point. It really leaves us in a bind as investors, and we start searching around for value, better relative value. And, of course, near the beginning of this year, investors said, wait, there's value, especially in a negative rate environment, over $13 trillion worldwide now in debt and sovereign debt going into negative territory. That really makes precious metals an intriguing alternative. And whether or not you like them or not, or whether you even allocate any to a portfolio or not, the story is compelling now after many tough years.
Yeah, I used to follow the precious metals markets a lot more closely than I do now, Chris. But certainly on a long time being around basis, saying that, you know, we know, although some people might argue, but gold is really the ultimate money, and that there is definitely value there. The question becomes, what are people willing to trade up for? What kind of risk are they willing to take? I mean, the old expression used to be that an ounce of gold would always buy a good quality man's suit. I don't know what that means anymore, because you can get a decent quality man's suit for $300 or $400, but the kind of quality that we're talking about may be more like $1,000 or $2,000 suit. So is gold overpriced here? I don't believe it is, but it's obviously in a situation where it faces what we might all be facing, and that is a deflationary situation. And I'm just not smart enough to know what's going to happen with gold in a deflationary situation. I can give you an argument for a move in either direction. I think the most important area to touch on, and it's not a timing tool, and it doesn't tell us where the market's going to be next month, next week, or next year, but we are, without question, once again, and it's happened now 3 times in the last decade and a half, in one of the most overvalued markets in history. I would encourage, I don't know if you ever speak to them in terms of interview, Chris, but I would encourage your subscribers and your listeners to listen to Hussman of Hussman Econometrics. He's got a website. It's free. It doesn't cost any money. Go and look at his interpretation of where we are valuation-wise, and he actually has a valuation metric that has worked over a long period of time, over the last century, let's say, as opposed to the so-called Federal Reserve valuations and all these little game-playing things out there that really have nothing to do with true value or undervalued or overvalued measurements in the stock market. We are truly at one of the most overvalued levels in the history of the stock market.
Everyone listening to Peter Leidy's voice today will have links for you. Just click those links at the website or the email as you come across it. Really interesting information at the HussmanFunds.com. I think that's the one you're referring to.
Yes, it is. And he does a weekly commentary. I don't know what it's listed under, but it's on his main website. And I think it's under weekly commentary.
He shares your idea, basic premise on market cycles and themes and biases. Very interesting reading. So I hope folks will look into that there. We'll definitely put up the links there as well as to Peter Leidy's market cycles as well. Hope you have an excellent summer sabbatical.
Always fun to talk to you, Chris. Thank you.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. If you listen carefully to the myriad of media topics there are to keep one's analytical skills occupied 24/7, there is one topic that occasionally surfaces but doesn't get any significant airplay. However, I believe it represents one of the greatest threats to America, to individual rights, and the freedom of everyone. It's the idea of a constitutional convention. The Constitution today is a two-edged sword. It is the foundation for our existence as a country, and must be preserved at all costs. However, those who choose to call themselves constitutionalists or vocally support it have been, by some circles in government, branded as potential enemies of the state, as in supporters of Ron Paul for president in 2008. No, quite the opposite is true. The Constitution is the final bedrock of the very essence of what America is. And despite all the BS we're dealing with right now, as in fake news, Russia conspiracies, financial irresponsibility from virtually all Republicans and Democrats, censorship being imposed by social media companies designed to discriminate against, demonetize, and disappear contrarian and politically incorrect points of view. Despite all this and countless other issues we could list out for a full hour, these pale in comparison to the outright threat that a constitutional convention could and would bring to the very foundation of America. The few stories circulating on this subject seem to take the angle that for the reason of having such a convention would be to impose financial discipline on Congress. Great concept, wrong medium in which to achieve it. If the debt-based money system and derivatives our economy is built upon crumbles because of irresponsibility, let it. The consequences will be less compared to the risk, and it's a gigantic risk, of opening the lock box of the Constitution to significant, unadvertised, unintended changes that would occur, despite whatever rationalizations and justifications are given to sell it to the public. Oh, there will be bipartisan support for such an effort when it finally takes center stage. But don't you be fooled. It will be the grandest illusion, misdirection, and magic trick you have ever seen. You must resist it regardless of how persuasive everyone in the media becomes. Because if you're annoyed by the bogus Russia meddling narrative into the recent presidential election, just you wait until there is a constitutional convention and see who tries to meddle with and dismantle the structural supports of what it is that truly makes America great. When it comes to the Constitution, we don't need to make America great again. We need to keep it great by resisting at all costs any discussion of a constitutional convention. We already have enough tools, enough laws, and enough know-how to solve any problem we currently face. What we lack are leaders with discipline who are willing to be accountable for their actions. Our elected officials and those hidden hierarchies of power that control them are not mature enough to handle a constitutional convention. There are many aspects of this topic I will address in coming discussions. But understand, a constitutional convention would be a coup de grace, the ultimate coup that America cannot afford. A constitutional convention would open the door to a true compromise between food and poison. And in that kind of a compromise, it is only death that wins. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.